Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the ESI Bytes Show. Real pleased to have an interesting show today. These shows are focused on trying to get the information related to electronic discovery, as seen through the eyes of experts, accessible to virtually anyone for a price everyone can afford, which is free. My name is Carl Shineman. I'm with Jurnov, and today we have with us Ron Hedges. And Ron has an impressive background. He served as a United States Magistrate Judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007. He's a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board, participates in Sedona working groups on e-discovery and records, international e-discovery, confidentiality, public access. Those are very interesting committees. Ron's also a member of the advisory boards of the Advanced E-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Initiatives of Georgetown University's Law Center, where he teaches e-discovery and evidence as an adjunct faculty member. He has numerous publications. He's a consultant on e-discovery and records management issues. Can be reached at r_hedges@live.com. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
And you know, one of the things I ask everyone starting off, because I think it's interesting in this new field, is how did you first become interested in electronic discovery?
It actually came to me through a dispute that parties were having in a patent infringement action, where there was a question about preservation of email and the like, and I had, not surprisingly, had e-discovery-related decisions and issues before me before that, but this matter came out in around 2004, and it involved questions about preservation of email, or more really, failure to preserve email, and led me to impose an adverse inference instruction and costs. And then after that, I became involved with the Sedona Conference, and since then, I have spent a lot of time dealing with e-discovery and evidence issues.
Okay, well, let's talk about your top 10 list, which is the topic of today, the top 10 e-discovery decisions. And I want to mention it. You covered this in an article you wrote for an excellent publication, Digital Discovery and E-Evidence, which was published by BNA. This article was published on January 1, 2009, so there's a New Year's type of a feel to it. Good publication. Carol Iano is a very good friend of mine. And, you know, so starting off with the article, why did you decide to write this article?
I really decided to write it because it was coming towards the end of the year. We were several years into the e-discovery amendments to the federal rules, and I speak on e-discovery often, and I speak in e-discovery in the context of trends and development. And this article was a way for me to focus on where I thought e-discovery was going and what I saw to be some major decisions that had come out in the area.
Was there any particular criteria you used to come up with the list?
Well, first I wanted decisions that came out after the rule amendments went into effect, which was December 1 of 2006. Then I concentrated on federal courts because obviously only the federal courts are going to be bound by the federal rules. But having said that, there are some exceptions as we go through this one way or the other that I think will make a little sense, because it's really not top 10. It's a little more about 14 or so. But there are a lot of issues going on in the world of e-discovery.
And since I have the list in front of me, quick question. I saw the Zubelake decisions didn't make the list, and since Judge Shinlin's doing a podcast tomorrow, and you know, as you know, I had my fourth C wine based on Zubelake, I'm curious, first, did my labeling a bottle of wine cheapen the decision and hurt its chances to get on the list?
No. Zubelake actually was decided before the rule amendments went into effect. So it didn't make the list for that matter. But in any event, Zubelake is so well known, and everyone cites Zubelake for one reason or another. I just didn't see that it should be going on the list.
Okay, well, let's go through the list, and in order of the article, and I'm going to omit sites, but when we do the transcript, I'm going to ask that we add the sites for the transcript, and the article you could find as well. Kash La Poudre Feeds, LLC versus Land O'Lakes.
It's a lot easier just to talk about it in terms of it being Land O'Lakes.
Okay.
But having said that, this was written by Craig Schaefer, and the audience should be aware that in the area of electronic discovery, magistrate judges really do a lot of the work because the magistrate judges do case management and the like. And this decision is written by Craig Schaefer, a magistrate judge in Denver. And it talks about the nature of when a litigation hold should be considered to be needed. And actually, interestingly, there looks at some equivocal letters that had been sent in by counsel to what would be the defendant and concluded the nature of these letters were, as I said, equivocal and didn't give rise to the hold in the first instance. Also, it's interesting because it talks about the obligation to see what happens to electronically stored information that ex-employees might have had and actually addresses a failure to preserve that type of information. So this is in because it talks about preservation, when the trigger for litigation happens, and also because it talks about what has to be done when you're putting a litigation hold together to make it effective.
I should mention Tom French, one of the lawyers on that case, appeared on the first podcast we did with Judge Facciola. And it's, you know, it was a very interesting case. Columbia Pictures, Inc. versus Bunnell.
Well, this is the case that started everyone being concerned 2 years ago or so about the preservation of what you could call ephemeral information. And ephemeral information here was random access memory. Those people on the podcast who may understand what that concept is, it's data that can come in and out of a computer in an incredibly short period of time and is not stored. But the information was highly relevant there. And actually, the duty to preserve attached, if you read the opinion, when the court ordered it as opposed to being in the first instance. So this talks about the scope of what electronically stored information is, which really includes random access memory, and also talks about what happens when that type of information is relevant and whether or not a party has an obligation to keep it.
Okay. The next case is Doe v. Norwalk Community College.
I should back up, though, for a second and talk about Columbia Pictures because it's the first civil decision I've seen that really applies or talks about the European Privacy Directive as that was enacted in the Netherlands and orders production.
Yeah, if you could expand on that, what's the European Privacy Directive about?
The European Privacy Directive was enacted by the European Parliament in the 1990s, and its intent is to protect, more than anything else, personal information of individuals. So what happens is once the EU has the Privacy Directive in force, the EU member countries move to enact national legislation that follows the directive. The simplest thing to describe this is to say that it is illegal to process and export data outside the EU or a member company of the EU without specific permission. And that creates problems when data is in Europe and is needed in the United States for litigation.
I should also mention we did a podcast last week with Jim Daly on navigating the international rules of e-discovery. The next case is Doe v. Norwalk Community College.
Doe v. Norwalk talks about the imposition of sanctions. And I put it in particularly because it has a discussion of Rule 37E, which is the so-called safe harbor rule. And effectively what happened in Doe is that there was no type of controls put over preservation holds or routine deletion of information, and 37E was not applicable because of that. 37E, I think it's fair to say, has been a great disappointment to those who first proposed it, and Doe is one of the decisions that rejects the application of 37A.
Interesting. I think that was the rule. You were at the Georgetown conference a couple of years ago where we were all talking about it as a speed bump instead of a safe harbor.
It originally started to be called a safe harbor. After there were criticisms about that, John Redgrave, who I understand is going to be speaking today
in
or
about
tomorrow,
an hour,
came up with the concept of it being a lighthouse because it points away to be safe. And I wrote an article and said it was an uncharted minefield because you didn't know what it was going to be like when you got into it, because there are so many ifs and conditions on the application of 37E. I really think it's more of a problem than it is a solution.
Okay. The next case is in re eBay seller antitrust litigation.
eBay was put in because it is an excellent discussion of the privileged nature of retention hold notices that might be sent out within some type of an organization once litigation becomes reasonably contemplated. Those notices, as a general proposition, are subject to attorney-client and work product, with the understanding, though, of course, the steps taken to secure data, maintain data, and the like, were discoverable. And I should also point out that Paul Grimm was a co-author of an article in the University of Baltimore Law Review last year that really talks about the subject in detail.
Okay. Maybe he'll do a future podcast. Haka v. Lincoln Country.
Lincoln County. This is my number one decision. And it's interesting because it's what you would call a small case. It's a pro se plaintiff, as a matter of fact. And the judge makes an eminently sensible statement that you really don't know what's in ESI until you find it, which is true of anything, of course. But I think it needs to put ESI into perspective. And it also talks about the need to take incremental steps to secure ESI as opposed to cost shifting. And whenever I speak, I talk to people and tell them, in my thought, judges are not very happy with doing cost shifting. And this is an alternative to cost shifting, the concept of the incremental approach to doing discovery. So Hack is a very important case, I think.
Yeah, I've talked to Laura Zubelik about this, and she hates the concept of cost shifting.
Well, she should. Because she had 25% of the cost shifted to her, I believe, in the Zubelik opinion.
Yeah. Okay. The next case is John B. V. Goetz.
John B. V. Goetz, interesting, was a matter that I was appointed a special monitor in. The judge in that case, the district judge, had become frustrated, I suppose is the word, with the steps taken by the state of Tennessee to turn information over to an adversary and ordered very intrusive review of adversary systems, including personal computer systems, by an expert. It went up on a mandamus to the Court of Appeals, and putting the constitutional issues aside of federal and state comedy, the decision basically said, look, you can't get access to an adversary's systems unless you really show something has been done wrong in the production. And the case was remanded, and there is a plethora of case law now coming out and still addressing this concept of when do you get access to an adversary's data systems. And the answer generally is you need to have some demonstration of relevance as well as some kind of conduct by the responding party that provokes the court to allow access.
Okay, the next case is Knife Source LLC v. Wachovia Bank.
My number two opinion. This just says that just because you take paper, convert it into electronic format, that doesn't make it not reasonably accessible. So this is one of the first decisions that really came out that talked about what not reasonably accessible means, and you need to do more than just say, I've got it in a certain format, to fall within the scope of non-production under Rule 34.
Okay,
26B2B.
Okay. The next case is a Rule 26 decision also, Mancia v. Mayflower Textile Services Company. Maybe you can talk a little bit about Rule 26 as well.
Rule 26 imposes a certification obligation on attorneys, both when they serve discovery requests and when they respond to discovery requests. And it effectively dovetails with part of the rules of professional responsibility or rules of professional conduct that require you to act reasonably in litigation so as not to be oppressive and the like. And in this opinion, written again by Judge Grimm, what we see is the court admonishing the parties to comply with Rule 26G, be specific in your requests, be appropriate in your responses, and live up to the obligation that you have imposed on you both by the rules as well by as your ethical responsibilities in making discovery requests and responding to discovery requests.
Okay.
It's the first decision that really talked about 26G in this context. There are one or two earlier decisions, but this concentrates on 26G.
That also, Ron, whatever your cough, it's coming to me.
I apologize.
Can't apologize.
I've been trying to get rid of a cough for weeks now, and I can't do it.
This is a sympathy cough.
Okay. All right.
Anyway,
I'm sorry.
You know, that mentioned Richard Brayman, who runs the Sedona Conference, is doing a show in a few weeks on the Cooperative Proclamation, which
mm-hmm.
I think ties into this. So,
the Cooperation Proclamation is actually one of my other key developments that's listed in the article, so we can skip to that now if you want. And there is a concern that the cost of discovery and the need to engage in what I call satellite discovery, which is discovery about discovery, is swallowing up the merits process and is also starting to cost an incredible amount of money, both for parties and in court resources. The proclamation, the cooperation proclamation that was issued by Sedona, as well as this decision, Mancia said, look, you can be advocates, you can be adversaries, but you can do it in appropriate ways. And there are a number of areas where cooperation is something that should be worked on and looked to between the parties. And we're going to come to another decision in a little while where there's a discussion about that.
Okay. McPeak v. Ashcroft.
McPeak v. Ashcroft is written by another magistrate judge who's one of the leaders in this area, and that's John Facciole in the District of Columbia. And this is not a case decided after December 1, 2006. This was decided actually in 2001. This is the first real decision that came out about the need for sampling. And it's in here because, as far as I'm concerned, it is the leading decision on sampling that has been issued, talking about the need to do that as opposed to getting into the question of cost shifting to some degree, and also getting into the question of restoration of enormous amounts of data when you're not quite sure what the data is going to say.
Okay. The next one's the scary decision, Qualcomm Inc. v. Broadcom Corporation.
Well, interestingly, there is a new scary decision that came out not that long ago. And that one talks about responsibilities of inside counsel and outside counsel and the like. This is called Bray and Gillespie Management versus Lexington Insurance Company. It was just decided within the last few months out of Florida. But Qualcomm is the quintessential case of a dispute between inside and outside counsel as to who did what, or more likely, who did not do what they were supposed to do in litigation. The problem here was that in the course of a trial, through cross-examination of a witness, it was learned that there was a lot of email traffic involving a party and a third party. And the upshot of non-production of all that was that there were severe sanctions imposed, both monetary and case dispositive sanctions. And in addition, there was a referral of attorneys to a magistrate judge for consideration of additional sanctions. The magistrate judge recommended, among other things, referral of them for discipline to the California State Bar. Matter went up to the district court. It was reversed, effectively, the district court saying the hands of the outside attorneys were tied in front of the magistrate judge because of confidentiality concerns. They could not talk about what had happened between them and inside counsel. The district judge reversed the magistrate judge, remanded, saying that the attorney-client privilege had been abrogated because of the allegations. And that happened a while ago, and there it sits. So I think everyone is waiting to see what, if anything, comes out of that decision and the whatever hearing that's going to be conducted in front of the magistrate judge.
The cooperation proclamation goes internally also to people on the same side, right?
One of the concerns that John Facciole has expressed, and this is a theme of John's now when he speaks, is that he is concerned that the complexities and problems of e-discovery may be going towards creating some type of animosity between inside and outside counsel, which is obviously something our system can't have. Now, whether or not there is such an erosion, I really can't say as a matter of fact, but certainly when you read some cases, including the Bray decision, which I mentioned before, there are problems that can arise if there isn't proper coordination inside one party.
Yeah, I should mention John Facciola. Honorable John Facciola is one of the inspirations of the ESI Byte show, and we did the first show with him earlier on another one of his concerns, which is the fact that many small law firms and solo practitioners are not making much of an effort to learn this field, and you know, that's deeply troubling.
Well, one of my themes when I speak is that I unfortunately also see a coming divide between federal and state practice in this area, primarily because state courts really, I don't think, have the resources, which of course they should have, to be able to educate judges enough on the issues and complexities that happen in this area.
Hmm. Next decision is Quan v. Arch Wireless Operating Company.
Quan came out of the Ninth Circuit, and as a matter of fact, a relatively short time ago, the Ninth Circuit denied a rehearing en banc in this issue. And this is a couple things. First, it's the question of employee use of an employer's system for some reason, whether or not there is a right of privacy or an expectation of privacy if you do that. And second, it applied something called the Stored Communications Act, which generally speaking prohibits ISPs from disclosing the content of email traffic or the like. That's the easiest way to describe it. So this is in there because, again, it talks about expectations of privacy that individual might have, as well as a discussion of the SCA.
It's almost like a European decision, huh?
There is a lot of case law that's arisen now in the use of employer systems by employees. And it generally comes down to saying, if the employer puts the employee on notice that there is no right of privacy, if the employer more or less polices it, there is no expectation of privacy. And usually it comes up in a context, or it's come up several times in a context, of an employee communicating with an outside attorney, and the attorney-client privilege has been lost because of using an employer system. And I think as we're going forward, matter of fact, I just read an article today, about the use of cloud computing. You're going to see a lot more problems now with employees, whether they're government employees or private employees, making use of third-party systems and the like to communicate and having problems with loss of privacy and privilege.
Absolutely. Every Microsoft commercial out these days talks about the cloud, and it's growing, no doubt about it.
Someone showed me a diagram she had done that has a umbrella with the clouds over it, and I suggested you put under the umbrella all the water leaking through to go down into the corporate systems or government systems and see where we go from that.
Completely unrelated, but I ran a virtual law firm I created out of my own mind for a couple of years, and I did everything online with client access and a network of lawyers accessing. It's out there. It works from an operations standpoint, but my God, what an e-discovery nightmare.
Well, not only are the e-discovery nightmares there, we really are not going to be talking about confidentiality here or data security, but when you're going outside and using these common systems or the like, we can call them that, you really have to give a serious degree of consideration to how confidential that information is in the hands of that third party or the like. And in addition to that, what are the data security problems and concerns about data breaches you might have? But that's something for another day.
I just couldn't make any money doing it, so.
Anyway,
Smith v. Cafe Asia.
Great little case. This talks about preserving images effectively on cell phones. And it just is in here. It's another decision by Judge Facciola. And it talks about whether that is electronically stored information. The answer is yes. But also because of the personal nature of that information, It's not allowed to be disclosed in the course of discovery. It's going to be held on for a later time when we're concerned about trial. Great decision talking about the scope of ESI, what ESI can consist of, and the duty to preserve that type of what we can call somewhat exotic information.
Okay, we're into the last three here. State of Texas, the City of Frisco.
This was a novel attempt by the Texas DOT to deal with what it might have had in the nature of a preservation obligation. DOT receives a letter from a municipality, and rather than implement a hold, at least as far as we know, it files a declaratory judgment action, trying to get a federal court to declare, even before litigation is commenced, what its duties were to preserve. The court found that there wasn't a sufficient case or controversy, did not let it proceed, but it's an interesting way that someone might conceive of to try to resolve the question of a preservation duty, again, before litigation commences.
Yeah, I think we're going to do a podcast on that with David Reese here in Pittsburgh on because that's one of the big issues that lawyers that get into e-discovery cases sometimes rue when they look back. I didn't take the right steps of preservation, and now it's too late.
Well, that's why one reason why Rule 26F is so important. I have an article coming out in the next month or so on the centrality of 26F to the whole scheme of electronic discovery now. I do think it's fair to say if you read the law behind the Declaratory Judgment Act, even if there is a case or controversy, application of the act is discretionary. I have serious doubts you're going to see many federal judges wanting to entertain this. But we'll see. I can listen to the podcast and we can hear what it said then.
You can get on and chat questions if you want.
But I would love to do that.
We'll get to that later.
Okay.
Victor Stanley Inc. v. Creative Pipe Inc., the often quoted Victor Stanley case.
It's interesting now because there are consultants out there that are saying that they're Victor Stanley compliant, whatever that means. This was a case, again, where the need to cooperate was stressed by Judge Grimm throughout the opinion, noting that the defendant in this case just did not enter into an unwaiver agreement, and it had a number of opportunities to do it. The defendant produced information, claimed privilege, tried to get it back, and Judge Grimm said, you haven't proven your processes, you haven't shown you've been reasonable in doing privilege review, and held that the privilege was waived. But this is also very important because it talks about what might be the need for experts to address these issues, which picks up on decisions that Judge Facciola wrote in United States versus O'Keefe in another case called Equity Analytics, where he talked about the need for some type of expert assistance when you're coming in, for example, to create search terms and the like.
Boy, if I had an unlimited fund budget, I'd do my follow-up to the 4C Discovery Wine with a I'm Victor Stanley compliant T-shirt or something like that. What a
I've heard consultants say that I am Victor Stanley compliant. I've also heard consultants say that I am 37E compliant and that I am Federal Rule of Civil Procedure compliant.
You get the whole range of marketing ability and inability out of those statements, but anyway.
Yeah, it's pretty strange, but that's another issue. All right.
The last case here, Jim Daly touched upon a little bit in the international context, In Re Advocate Christopher X.
And this is a mistake on my part because the criminal prosecution in France did not arise out of a discovery request made in a court in New York. It arose out of a discovery request made in a court in California. But the principle is the same. The United States courts, as a general proposition, are going to exercise their discretion, apply the federal rules of civil procedure, and require parties to produce information, even if it is in another country. And unfortunately for this poor attorney in France, he was complying with some court orders or requests in the United States, and he wound up being prosecuted for violation of the French anti-blocking statute. And he was convicted of that, and the conviction was affirmed. So there's a little salutary warning for people who are seeking discovery overseas or who think it may be easy to get discovery overseas.
Yeah, I joke that the the objective, if we can't solve the distinctions between the two systems, is to find a lawyer who will take the fall for you in another country.
Unfortunately, that's what happened to this poor guy. But that's a major issue, and Jim is very knowledgeable in the subject, does a lot of work on it and a lot of speaking on it, and I expect it's only going to get worse as we move forward, because there are attempts now, or there are discussions now in Asia to have some type of a counterpart of the privacy directive. Certainly, we're going to be seeing more litigation Asia-centric or Pacific-centric as time goes on. So I expect this is only going to get more complex and more difficult.
Okay. Now, the last point you wanted to make and you made in the article was key developments that aren't tied into case law. We talked about the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation. You also cited the Federal Rule of Evidence 502 as being a significant theme. What do you mean by that?
Well, I see it as being significant in what it intends to do, which is to allow a judge to enter a non-waiver order in a federal court, for example, here where I am in New Jersey, and have that order binding across the United States, both in state and federal courts. So in a sense, what you see here is Congress federalizing the law of privilege to some degree, and also attempting to create uniform standards to look at privilege waiver issues. It's come up really in the context of waiver so far. I have not seen any orders arising out of this 502 rule yet that really have this non-waiver provision in it. But again, I expect it's something we're going to see over time. It's also a question to me whether it is going to spur quick peek agreements in an attempt to cut down privilege review costs. But we'll see. It's a new rule.
September
it's only
19th,
been in effect since September.
Yeah, September 2008, so mm-hmm. It is new. All right, last sort of question. Something interesting in our pre-podcast conversation. You talked about your sense about whether there be a future top 10 list at the end of this year maybe, and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the broad contours of e-discovery are starting to settle. We're starting to see a willingness to have native production or courts to order production in native if there is a need for it. On the other hand, something new seems to come up every day that may cause me to change it. So I see that we're going to have a continuing evolution under the federal rules as amended now. I think one of the areas that courts and parties are going to have to be very careful about is how you are going to relate the new technologies to the rules. The rules are intended to be technology neutral, but we still, as attorneys and judges, need to consider what exactly the technology is, what does it preserve and not preserve, and what it costs when parties start making arguments and courts issue decisions on new technologies. And a perfect example for this now, there was a big outcry, or not an outcry, a big area of interest in a decision out of Australia a little while ago that allowed service of process by Facebook. Now, interesting question. It's how are we as a society or under the federal rules going to allow service of process or other things by non-traditional means?
My
so
kids
I think
would love
there's
it.
A lot of growth.
My kids would love it, and I actually, you know, technology creates, you know, novel applications, as it should. You know, we're all trying to be more efficient. That's what technology
yep.
offers, but it keeps us all on our toes.
And there's an article actually in the February issue of Digital Discovery I co-authored that talks about that decision a little bit and calls it virtual jurisdiction, although we didn't invent the term. A court did some time ago.
Okay. Well, that's Ron, thanks so much for joining us on this this presentation, which really was more about themes and trends in e-discovery through some decisions. I think this is a very good podcast. I appreciate your joining us for this.
And then I apologize for coughing. I just cannot get rid of this cold or whatever I have. Or maybe when the weather turns warm, I will.
Okay.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we'll look forward to having you on future shows. Thanks again, Ron.
Goodbye.
Take care. Bye.